This is day five of the 2007 Palm Springs Bible School. Our first period teacher is Brother Nigel Patterson. His topic is Jesus as John saw him. Today's topic is the Lord is risen. Brother Nigel.
Do you realize that if it wasn't for three words, you wouldn't be here, nor would I? If it wasn't for three words, I wouldn't even know you. Oh, by the way, good morning. How are you? Sorry. They're not here in John, but they're in Mark. He is risen. Brethren and sisters, if that is not true, you are wasting your time here, frankly. We have nothing in common. And here John now, in this 20th chapter, brings his record of the gospel, it seems to me, to a triumphant climax. This is Christ crucified, Christ raised. And then you look at the disciples, utterly bewildered. They were not expecting this. They were not expecting the crucifixion, that is for sure. They were not expecting a resurrection. And in spite of the number of times in which Jesus told them, A, that he would be crucified, B, that he would be raised from the dead, nope, it just did not sink in at all for them. For the moment, we now have a truly bewildered group of men and women. I know we're in John 20, but you just come back to Luke for a second to pick up his take on this. It's chapter 23 of Luke, and then verse 55. Nobody believed Jesus when he said he will be raised from the dead. I mean, look at verse 55 of Luke 23. The women also, which came with him, that's with Joseph of Arimathea, came with him from Galilee, followed after, and beheld the sepulchre, how his body was laid. That's the first thing. And then, as if to make the point rather more pointedly, if that's not bad English, they returned and then prepared spices and ointments. There's no notion at all here of anything to be expected other than this body will be given a decent burial. That's all they have in mind. And nothing changes, and I'm now back in John chapter 20, nothing changes on the first day of the week. Because here comes, well, John simply records Mary Magdalene here. There's no contradiction, is there? Because in verse 2, she says, and we know not where they've laid him. As far as John is concerned, he's simply homed in on her, but she's speaking for the other women who were with her. The first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early, when it was yet dark, unto the sepulchre, and sees the stone taken away from the sepulchre. The tomb is empty, and an assumption is now made by her, and I've kind of hinted at that, because she goes back to Simon Peter in verse 2, and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, John, and said unto them, they've taken away the Lord out of the sepulchre, and we've no idea where they've laid him. Resurrection is the furthest thing from her mind, and in fact from anybody else's mind. Well, of course, at this point, that verse introduces two more people onto the scene, Peter and John. They're in verse 3. And then this is clearly eyewitness detail. No question about this. So they ran both together, verse 4. The other disciple did outrun Peter and came first to the sepulchre. He, stooping down, looking in, saw the linen cloths lying, depending which version you've got there, lying, yet went he not in. Then cometh Simon Peter following him, and went into the sepulchre, and seeth the linen cloths lie, and the napkin that was about his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but wrapped together in a place by itself. The detail is really quite important, isn't it? Though we shan't dwell on this massively, but three times in those verses, it is stated that the linen cloths are not on the body. They're separated from the body. We appear to here to have life present in death. In the actual grave clothes, still lying, I'm suggesting, in their original folds, untouched by human hands, and yet no longer containing the crucified body. The body had been moved, but not the grave clothes. Now that is something special. And notice this in verses 6 and 7. Peter went in, and he saw more than John because he'd gone in. Right? At that particular moment. We are told quite explicitly in verse 7, the napkin which had been placed over the head was rolled up, revised version, was rolled up in a place by itself. I don't ask you to turn back to the Luke record, but there's just a simple little comment from Luke that tells you exactly what happened in the next moment. All right, so you've got a picture here of John 20. Peter's gone in there. He sees the cloths. He sees the napkin quite separated, rolled up in a place by itself. And it's Luke who then tells us, "Then rose Peter, ran into the sepulchre, stooping down, beheld the linen clothes laid by themselves, and departed wondering." He leaves a wanderer. He does not believe. Now it's John's turn, verse 8. He goes in, he's described here as that disciple who came first to the sepulchre, and he saw exactly the same thing that Peter saw. And now it is recorded, he believed. He came away a believer. I mean, it's worth pointing out the word saw here in verse 8 is not the same as in, say, verse 5 and 6. 5 and 6 is about physical sight. It's a different word in verse 8. This is when you see something more deeply. This is perception. John saw with the eye of the mind now and grasped the truth which lay beneath what he was looking at. This is where we started, brethren and sisters. I just briefly refresh your memory. We have once this week been to someone's wedding. We were in Cana. We were watching what happened when Mary, clearly involved in the general arrangements for that wedding, had to come to Jesus and say, "Well, my word, you know, we've run out of wine." And we know what that means, don't we? So we discovered for ourselves when we looked at that in detail. But it was the way in which we are told by John that the servants knew what had happened, that they'd seen what Jesus did. The master of the ceremonies didn't, and hence his comment about the best had been saved till last. The servants had seen, but John makes it very clear, so had the disciples, but they came away believing. There was a miracle there which was seen at two different levels. In a kind of way, we've come full circle once more in John. And that's what we have before us here. It seems to me, at any rate. I mean, there is some debate as to what precisely was being looked at here. Grave clothes, possibly stiffened by the spices. Myrrh, I understand, if in contact with cloth, does stiffen it quite markedly. And if myrrh had been placed in there with the body, the clothes and the cloth even loosely around the body of Jesus, we can see that those grave clothes would be stiffened by the spices to roughly the shape of Jesus' body. The text doesn't necessarily require that, but it's a thought. So it wasn't just that they saw the cloths. The cloths had a particular shape. I have a feeling that's what sent Peter away wondering. I mean, yeah, maybe Mary's comment really is the clue. She was convinced that someone had taken the body, and Peter's bewilderment revolved around the question, well, wait a minute, why would anybody want just to take the body and leave the clothes? And what's that all about? I mean, if you're in the business of just body snatching, you just take the lot and you run, don't you? But clearly that hasn't happened here. The body's gone, but the clothes are still there, possibly in the shape of the body. It's not until John looks at this that it dawns on him that no one has taken the body. And a miracle has taken place, the most amazing miracle of all time. You see, John's only got one other resurrection to go on, hasn't he? That's the one we were looking at yesterday. He'd seen the resurrection of Lazarus, and in that particular instance, at this point, I'm not refreshing your memory, I'm refreshing mine to make sure I get the right words here. He that was dead came forth bound hand and foot with grave clothes. His face was bound about with a napkin. Yeah, so we get the link here, but that's all that John, that's John's only experience of resurrection. That man, Lazarus, came from the tomb wearing the grave clothes and the additional burial cloth, the napkin, still wrapped around his head. Jesus' resurrection appears to be something quite different. The body apparently having passed through those grave clothes, spices and all. Imagine that. In much the way that he will later appear in a locked room. We'll have a look at that in a moment. It'll later in this 20th chapter. I mean, and the description of the napkin that had been around Jesus' head does not suggest that it kept the shape of the corpse. That's not what the Revised Version presents to us. It just talks about it as though it's been very neatly rolled up by somebody, as if to say, don't need that anymore. It's a powerful and vivid description, and is certainly not likely to have been made up. So a bit of running going on there by John and Peter, arriving at two quite different responses. Meanwhile, somebody somewhere else, there are two other people running, not necessarily at the same time, it's true, but they are running. They live 7 miles away from Jerusalem, a place called Emmaus. They have had their eyes open. They've just shared a meal with a man that they knew had been crucified and had been buried, and now had walked the road with them, talked to them, sent flames of understanding in their hearts. And now, straight back to Jerusalem. Interestingly, Jesus had been called into the house by those two because it was the end of the day. And apart from anything else, it wouldn't have been safe, would it, to be necessarily walking the roads after nightfall? Didn't seem to stop them on the way back. You know? Whatever dangers were out there on the road between Emmaus and Jerusalem, didn't matter. They had met a man who had defeated death. And they were going to Jerusalem to find the rest of the people and tell them, we've seen him. In that beautiful phrase that Jesus was made known unto them in the breaking of bread. That should be our Sunday morning experience every time. But that's another story. So they're on their way back. I don't imagine they'd move quite so fast in their lives ever. We will just pop back into Luke one more time, if I may, please. Because I think there is just this link here between how Luke sees it and how John takes up the story. It says there, verse 33, it's Luke 24, verse 33, they rose up the same hour, they returned to Jerusalem and found the 11 gathered together and them that were with them, saying, the Lord is risen indeed and hath appeared to Simon. That, I don't believe that is a comment that they're making to these two to confirm. I think they are, all of them are abuzz that Jesus is now alive again. This was not expected, remember. And they're simply, as these two come into the room, they tell them precisely what their experiences have been. Because you see, it's not until you get to verse 35 that these other two get a chance to get a word in edgeways. It's there, look, and they told what things were done in the way and how he was known of them in the breaking of bread. They burst in to a room which is just simply buzzing with excitement and can't get their own story in until after they've listened to everything that's been said by these disciples. And of course, when you get to the end of verse 35, you've got to just think about this. I can imagine some puzzlement now in the room. Oh, wait a minute. Well, let me just get this right. You saw him in Emmaus? I mean, that's 7 miles away here. Now, Peter saw him, well, we don't know where. That's a private affair, wasn't it, between Jesus and Peter. For these people, slowly but surely is dawning the possibility that Jesus has been in two places, not quite at once, but near enough, two places at once. This isn't just a raised body, this is a new experience altogether, isn't it? Can you not see the puzzlement in that room? How come you saw him in a mess, and we know, and they would know the timing of that visit that Jesus paid to Peter? No wonder they are abuzz with the events of the last few hours. Now then, is it at that moment in time, or perhaps a minute or two later, that what Luke records here in verse 36, we now find back in verse 19 in Luke chapter 20, which is where I've now gone, completely confusing you. All right? That same day, at evening, being the first day of the week, verse 19 of John 20, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus and stood in the midst and said unto them, "Peace be unto you." Now, as Luke records it, this entrance of Jesus is only a matter of minutes, possibly, after those two from Emmaus have arrived. It's a nice touch from John, unspoken. But not only did Jesus go with them from Jerusalem to Emmaus, he came back with them too. But they didn't know it. But then that's the experience of all saints and all disciples ever since. The Lord travels with us, but we don't see him. Not often, anyway. So, here they are in this room. You notice it's locked. There is still this sense of fear. You know, you can well understand the logic in the minds of these disciples before this particular event. I mean, they've got the leader. It's the followers next, and. You have to say it makes sense because of the way in which the authorities treated Peter and John and other disciples in the Acts of the Apostles. Okay, so they're in here. They're locked away for fear of the Jews. And somebody's missing. Somebody is not there. And we discover it's a disciple called Thomas. Now, in spite of the united insistence of the rest of them, he resolutely refuses to believe that Jesus has been raised from the dead. He's the odd one out here at the moment. And makes it very plain in verse... a little later on he will make it very plain that he only wants to see... And this is important, what they have seen. So verse 20, when he had so said, Jesus having come to the disciples, but Thomas not there, remember, when he had so said, he showed unto them his hands and his side. Then were the disciples glad when they saw the Lord. And so the insistence that he has been raised, and verse 24 makes it plain, Thomas is just not going to believe. So 1 week later now, 1 week later, the Lord enters the room with the doors closed. There is no mention here of the fear of the Jews now, by the way. That's missing. Which, again, speaks volumes for what is now changing in the minds and the hearts of these disciples. And maybe the peace be unto you is just that nice... salutation that comes from the Master to these people here. And this repetition, it says that in verse 26, you know. After, I didn't read the verse, I'm sorry, but I hope you're with me here. After 8 days again, his disciples were within, Thomas with them this time, and then came Jesus, the doors being shut. So that is mentioned, but not the fear of the Jews. The repetition of that clearly must be to emphasise the point that we really are looking at something quite different here. The ability to Jesus just to come and go at will, even when doors are closed and locked. This is the power of the new life. But that's not the issue. The real issue here is Jesus has come back for one person. Just one person. Because as he comes into the room, having said peace be unto, the next verse, verse 20 says, Thomas. That's why he's back. He's just come for Thomas. I mean, how unnerving to hear your own words now spoken by someone you thought wasn't there. Unless I see, Thomas. And he's invited to reach hither his finger and to see his hands and to reach hither his hand and to thrust it into the side of the Lord. And don't be faithless, but believe. Do you think he did it? I don't think so. I think that man just collapsed to the ground. Absolutely collapsed to the ground, onto his knees. And we should feel no discomfort with the language of my Lord and my God. There's nothing wrong with that. This man is just simply blown apart by what is now in front of him. And then there follows a beatitude that's not found in the Sermon on the Mount. It says, Jesus, blessed are they, middle of verse 29, blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed. If we have our wits about us, brethren and sisters, we suddenly find ourselves drawn into the story now. Here is a special blessing for that great number of believers who have never seen Christ in the flesh. But of course, it's Thomas we remember here, so-called doubting Thomas. And is that fair? Is that really fair? It is worth remembering that all the apostles had seen before they believed. All Thomas is asking is to go through the same process. He's not asking for anything special, is he? He wants to go through exactly the same process as the other disciples. And they did not believe, remember, until they had seen. I mean, even John's faith didn't show itself until he had the physical evidence placed before him. I mean, Thomas, it is true, had the opportunity of believing without seeing, but he rejected it. As had they all. So it's not the picture of doubt that we should recall here, but the fact that the Lord came for him. Is there something in the character of this man which needs support? Now, can I just take you ever so briefly back to chapter 11, verse 16? We were in this chapter yesterday, and this is the moment where Jesus makes the decision to go now, in response to the message, to go to Bethany and to, as he knows, to raise Lazarus. They don't. But it's just a little comment here, isn't it? The disciples having first of all said back, it's in chapter 11, verse 7, it says, Jesus says to them, let us go into Judea again. And they make the point, well, that's not a clever move. Because, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and you'd go again there, would you? And, right, he's clearly intent on doing this. And now verse 16, then said Thomas, who was called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. What a pessimist, huh? Of course, you know what they say about pessimists, they're never disappointed. Was it just a comment from this man that just possibly suggests something about the character? This is a man who, well, okay, you know, whatever, I'm with you through everything here, Lord. I'll go through it. If it all goes bad, then fine. You know, that's the way it is. Is that the kind of man that he is and who now needs this additional support from the Master on the day of the resurrection? I true, it's a speculative view of John 11 there, but is he someone who sticks doggedly with the master there back in chapter 11, but sees no good end to it all? So maybe Jesus here, I'm now back in John chapter 20, perhaps Jesus is dealing with Thomas, is an encouragement for those who want to believe, right, but find it a struggle sometimes. I mean, this further appearance does seem to be for his benefit. I just refresh your memory of the real Lord's Prayer, which is in chapter 17. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in thy name, says Jesus to his Father. Those that thou gavest me, I've kept. None of them is lost, but the son of perdition. None of them. Not even Thomas. So he had to come back, you see. He had to come back for Thomas. Just to support. I mean, Jesus so clearly knew what was going through his mind. And by the same token, therefore, brothers and sisters, he knows your doubts too. In all their detail and in all their circumstances. It's worth remembering, doubt is not a sin. Of course, we may ask, well, wait a minute, Thomas, you know, how come you weren't there, eh? What were you up to? Don't you think you should have been there? How come you weren't there? I mean, had he other pressing business that delayed him? Had he cut himself off from the rest of the 12 in an effort to work out his problems on his own? Which, again, I suggest, kind of captures possibly the kind of person he was. Well, whatever the reason, he missed the coming of the Lord by being by himself. We always are more likely to find him in the company of the faithful than in some lonely vigil where two or three are gathered together. Thomas, you should have been there, but he wasn't. And of course, this underlines how much brethren and sisters may lose by not regularly attending the ecclesial meeting. How much we lose through a lack of regular attendance at the meeting. Now, remember, attendance is not it's not about the registrar's bookkeeping, is it? In the end, it's about being in his book. And the very exhortation, or the other Bible time that we needlessly miss, may just have contained the very message our souls needed that day. The very gathering for praise and prayer from which we stayed away may be the very meeting that would have cheered us, would have strengthened us, would have encouraged us, would have uplifted our hearts. But we weren't there, and we missed that. What can we say then about doubting Thomas? I think it was honest doubt. Some doubters, of course, are just simply skeptics. I've got one or two ex-colleagues who are like that. Yeah? Protecting themselves from commitment. An excuse to escape from a sense of responsibility to some unseen God. But those who doubt sincerely, who long for certainty, will eventually come to full faith. There's a lovely little passage in Jeremiah 29, verse 13. It reads like this: you shall seek me and find me when you shall search for me with all your heart. I think that's Thomas. He definitely wanted to know. He wanted to be sure. He's not a skeptic. Not at all. It has to be a doubt, you see, that will face up to the evidence. Doubt that simply buries its head in the sand doesn't get anybody anywhere. Real doubt will examine the evidence very thoroughly. And when this man was given the evidence to investigate very thoroughly, just didn't do it. Didn't need to. Too often, doubt is simply an excuse for intellectual laziness. And it is just I know I keep coming to it, but at the end of our chapter now, many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples. I'm reading verse 30 of chapter 20, which are not written in this book, but these are written. You've got enough evidence, says John, that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. Just go back to chapter 17, ever so briefly for one verse. This is where you and I are definitely caught up in the story. It says in verse 20 there of John 17, "Neither pray I for these alone," for his immediate disciples there, "but for them also which shall believe on me through their word." These are the believers who've never seen, but they've heard. And John's words here at the end of chapter 20 are about these people here. And there in John 17, verse 20, the Lord Jesus Christ, way ahead of time, was offering a prayer for the likes of you and me. You are there, brother and sister, in verse 20. His care there as a shepherd for the sheep, 2,000 years ahead of time. But he cared then. Whereas for Thomas, seeing was believing. For subsequent saints, believing is seeing. It's through faith that we meet the risen Lord and enter into a personal relationship with him. And just a little comment from Peter now. If you'd like to come with me to 1 Peter and chapter 1. The one who got to the tomb first of those two and who went away just bewildered by what he had seen. Now look how he writes. Verse 3, it's 1 Peter, it's chapter 1 and verse 3. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again unto a living hope." This is John chapter 1 language, is it not? "By the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." I mean, the Authorized Version says again unto a lively hope. It's a living hope in the Revised Version. Of course it's a living hope. The man's alive. Our faith isn't based upon some great character of history. This man is alive. So it's a living hope that we have. But down to verse 8. "Whom having not seen," he speaks about the Lord Jesus Christ in verse 7, "whom having not seen, you love, in whom though now you see him not, yet believing, you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls." That's it. That's where we are. We're part and parcel of the people here who are described as the elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, back in verse 2. This is about you and me, even though this was not a letter to us, you know. It's not necessary for us to have been in Galilee with Jesus. We did not see him, and we do not now see him. But soon we shall, by God's grace. Peter here, in this little passage, contrasts the past and the present with the future. It's a living hope that we have. The day is coming when Jesus Christ of Nazareth, as we now have it in the Acts of the Apostles, will be revealed and our eyes will behold the one that we have trusted and loved. The one who has walked every Emmaus road that there's been for every saint. It's the same name, but it's a different road for each individual. But we've all been on the road to Emmaus. You have to have been on the road to Emmaus, otherwise you'll never find the road back to Jerusalem, that is for sure. Our eternal well-being is wrapped up in this man. He's the very centre of our life and being. And then we live for something. If that's our real thought, then we in a kind of way we can live something of the future now. And if we are willing truly to be his sheep, then like the good shepherd that he is, our Lord will be ever present and yet out of sight. I don't ask you to turn these two very short verses open. Let me just read them to you. But this is the spirit of Peter. It's the spirit of the Apostle Paul when he has this to say. "While we look not on the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. That was 2 Corinthians 4, and in the next chapter he has this to say, very simply, we walk, that's the road to Emmaus again, we walk by faith, not by sight. Jesus is God's provision for us. Don't spurn him, and don't doubt. My Lord and my God. Thomas's declaration is the last statement of personal faith recorded in this record of the Gospel. It marks the climax of the book because it presents Christ as the risen Lord, victorious over sin, victorious over sorrow, over death, and over doubt. It also presents the faith that accepts not only the truth of what Jesus said, but also the truth of who he is. Not was, is. He's alive. And I don't apologize for once more bringing you to the last two verses of John chapter 20, because this is where he's been aiming all the time. John has been working his way right through to this point. Many other signs, truly, did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. Signs then, signs now. This isn't the time and the place, but I believe there are five top tips for the second coming of Jesus. We have signs right now which should alert us to the coming of our Lord. Signs that we might believe and at last be granted life in his name, as John says. You sometimes hear people say, what's in the name? And the answer is everything when it's his.